about provisions. Chapter 4. The Lees of Fire. At 8 in the morning on November 25, 1819, the lookout cried, "Land ho!" In the distance, what appeared to be an island of rock towered high above the water. Without hesitation, Captain Pollard pronounced it to be Staten Island, off the eastern tip of Cape Horn. The crew was staring at this legendary sphinx-like sight when suddenly it dissolved in the hazy air. It had been nothing but a fog bank. The dangers of the Horn were proverbial. In 1788, Captain William Bligh and the crew of the Bounty had attempted to round this menacing promontory. After a solid month of sleet-filled headwinds and horrendous seas that threatened to break up the ship, Bligh decided that the only sensible way to reach the Pacific was to go the other way, so he turned the Bounty around and headed for Africa's Cape of Good Hope. 25 years later, during the War of 1812, a much larger vessel, also named the Essex, an American naval frigate commanded by Captain David Porter, rounded the Horn. Porter and his men would eventually become famous for their heroics against a superior British force in the Pacific, but Cape Horn put a fright into the otherwise fearless mariner. "Our sufferings, short as has been our passage, have been so great that I would advise those bound into the Pacific never to attempt the passage of Cape Horn, if they can get there by another route." The whalemen of Nantucket had a different attitude toward the Horn. They'd been rounding it regularly ever since 1791, when Captain Paul Worth steered the Beaver, a whale ship about the size of the Essex, into the Pacific. Pollard and Chase had done it at least 3 times. For Pollard, it may have been his 4th or even 5th time. Still, Cape Horn was nothing any captain took for granted, certainly not one who, like Pollard, had almost lost his ship in the relatively benign Gulf Stream. Soon after watching the Mirage Island vanish before them, the men of the Essex saw something so terrible that they could only hope their eyes were deceiving them once again. But it was all too real. From the southwest, a line of ink-black clouds was hurtling in their direction. In an instant, the squall slammed into the ship with the force of a cannon shot. In the shrieking darkness, the crew labored to shorten sail. Under a close-reefed main topsail and storm staysails, the Essex performed surprisingly well in the mountainous seas. "The ship rode over them as buoyantly as a seagull," Nickerson claimed, "without taking on board one bucket of water." But now, with the wind out of the southwest, there was the danger of being driven against the jagged rocks of the Horn. The days became weeks as the ship struggled against the wind and waves in near-freezing temperatures. In these high latitudes, the light never entirely left the night sky. Without the usual sequence of light and dark, the passage stretched into a dreary, seemingly unending test of a whaleman's sanity. It took more than a month for the Essex to round Cape Horn. Not until January of the new year, 1820, did the lookout sight the island of St. Mary's, a gathering spot for whalers off the coast of Chile. To the south of the island in the Bay of Arauca, they found several Nantucket vessels, including the Chile, the same ship with which they had left the island 5 months earlier. The news from the west coast of South America was not good. For one thing, the political situation in Chile and Peru was extremely volatile. In recent years, towns up and down the coast had been ravaged by fighting between the Patriots, who hoped to wrest control of South America from Spain, and the Royalists, whose interests were still linked to the mother country. Although the Patriot forces, assisted by the swashbuckling British naval hero Lord Cochrane, appeared in the ascendancy, fighting was still going on, particularly in Peru. Caution was the watchword when provisioning on this coast. For most vessels, it had been a miserable whaling season. While the scarcity of whales kept up the price of oil back home on Nantucket, these were tough times for whalemen in the Pacific. After driving his crew to fill his ship, the Independence, Captain George Swain had returned to Nantucket in November and predicted, "No other ship will ever fill with sperm oil in the South Seas." Obed Macy feared Captain Swain might be right. "Some new place must be found where the whales are more numerous," he told his journal, "or the business will not be worth pursuing." Praying that they might elude these grim forecasts, the crew of the Essex headed out to sea. After several luckless months off the Chilean coast, punctuated by a provisioning stop at Talcahuano, the Essex began to meet with some success off Peru. In just 2 months, Pollard and his men boiled down 450 barrels of oil, the equivalent of about 11 whales. This meant that they were killing, on average, a whale every 5 days, a pace that soon exhausted the crew. The weather only added to their labors. High winds and rugged seas made every aspect of whaling doubly onerous. Instead of providing a stable platform on which to cut up the blubber and boil the oil, the Essex pitched back and forth in the waves. The large seas made it next to impossible to lower and raise the whaleboats safely. Our boats were very much injured in hoisting them from the water, Nickerson remembered, and were on more than one occasion dashed in pieces by the heavy rolling of the ship. The much-abused boats were constantly in a state of repair. As the number of casks of oil in the hold increased, the greenhands became accustomed to the brutal business of whaling. The repetitious nature of the work, a whaler was, after all, a factory ship, tended to desensitize the men to the awesome wonder of the whale. Instead of seeing their prey as a 50- to 60-ton creature whose brain was close to 6 times the size of their own, and what perhaps should have been even more impressive in the all-male world of the fishery, whose penis was as long as they were tall, the whalemen preferred to think of it as what one commentator called a self-propelled tub of high-income lard. Whales were described by the amount of oil they would produce, as in a 50-barrel whale, and although the whalemen took careful note of the mammal's habits, they made no attempt to regard it as anything more than a commodity whose constituent parts, head, blubber, ambergris, etc., were of value to them. The rest of it, the tons of meat, bone, and guts, was simply thrown away, creating festering rafts of offal that attracted birds, fish, and, of course, sharks. Just as the skinned corpses of buffaloes would soon dot the prairies of the American West, so did the headless gray remains of sperm whales litter the Pacific Ocean in the early 19th century. Even the most repugnant aspects of whaling became easier for the greenhands to take as they grew to appreciate that each was just part of a process, like mining for gold or growing crops designed to make them money. That was why veteran whalemen had a special fondness for trying out the blubber, the final step in the transformation of a living, breathing sperm whale into cold, hard cash. It is horrible, the writer Charles Nordoff admitted, yet old whalemen delight in it. The fetid smoke is incense to their nostrils. The filthy oil seems to them a glorious representative of prospective dollars and delights. It was more than just the money. Each whale, each cask of oil, brought the Nantucketer closer to returning home to his loved ones. And it was when they were trying out the whale that the whalemen typically grew the most nostalgic for home. Wives and children are remembered with new affection at such moments, claimed William H. Macy, and each feels nearer home and friends at each recurring sound of the light-driven bung and the inspiring cry, "Away, cask!" Truly is it remarked by old whalemen that the most delightful parts of the voyage are boiling and arriving home. It was during this busy and exhausting 2-month stretch off Peru that the crew of the Essex received what was, for a whaleman, the ultimate motivator: letters from home. Toward the end of May, the Essex spoke or hailed the Aurora, the brand new ship fitted out by Gideon Folger and Sons for Daniel Russell, formerly the captain of the Essex. The Aurora had left Nantucket on the day after Christmas, bringing with her news that was only 5 months old, a blink of an eye in the time frame of a whaleman. When the Aurora left Nantucket, the price of whale oil was at an all-time high. People were still talking about the fire in Rhoda Harris's schoolroom in the black section of town known as New Guinea, and they were catching codfish, 200 to a boat, off the Nantucket village of Syosconset. But of most interest to the men was the pouch of mail, along with several newspapers, that Daniel Russell handed over to Captain Pollard. After the officers had selected their letters, the bag was sent forward to the crew. It was amusing to watch those of our lads who had been disappointed and found no letters for them, Nickerson recalled. They would follow us around the decks, and whilst we were reading our letters would seat themselves beside us, as though our letters could be of service to them. Despairing of finding out anything about their own families, the unlucky ones sought solace in what Nickerson called the careless folds of a newspaper. For his part, Nickerson would reread the newspapers so many times that he would soon have their contents memorized. The meeting between the Aurora and the Essex provided Pollard with the chance to speak with his former commander, the 34-year-old Daniel Russell. The Aurora was a much larger, state-of-the-art ship and would return to Nantucket 2 years later, full of oil. Later it would be said that when Captain Russell had left the Essex to assume command of the Aurora, he had taken his old ship's luck with him. One of the topics Pollard and Russell discussed was the recent discovery of a new whaling ground. As if to refute Captain Swain's dour prediction that the Pacific Ocean had been fished out of sperm whales, Captain George Washington Gardner of the Globe had headed farther out to sea in 1818 than any other Nantucket whale ship had so far dared to go. More than 1,000 miles off the coast of Peru, he hit the motherlode, an expanse of ocean full of sperm whales. He returned home to Nantucket in May of 1820 with more than 2,000 barrels of oil. Gardner's discovery became known as the offshore ground. During the spring and summer of 1820, it was the talk of the whale fishery. Understanding that whales appeared in the offshore ground in November, Pollard resolved to make one final provisioning stop in South America, where he'd secure plenty of fruits, vegetables, and water. Then, after touching at the Galapagos Islands, where he would pick up a load of giant tortoises, which were prized for their meat, he would head out for this distant section of ocean. Sometime in September, the Essex called at Atacama's, a little village of approximately 300 Spaniards and Indians in Ecuador, just north of the equator. Anchored beside them, they found a ghost ship, the whaler George from London, England. Every member of the George's crew, save for Captain Benneford and two others, had come down with a life-threatening case of scurvy after a long time at sea. Their condition was so serious that Benneford rented a house on shore and transformed it into a hospital for his men. Here was ample evidence of the dangers of venturing for extended periods out into the open Pacific. Although poor, Atacama's, called Tacames by the whalemen, was a beautiful town that for some sailors seemed a kind of Garden of Eden. I could not but admire the exuberant growth of everything belonging to the vegetable kingdom, recalled Francis Olmsted, whose ship put in at Atacama's in the 1830s. The most delicious pineapples spread out before us, while the coconut tree, the plantain, and the banana waved their broad leaves gracefully in the breeze. Here were oranges, limes, and other fruits, lying scattered around in neglected profusion. The fig trees had also begun to put forth, and the indigo plant grew spontaneously, like the most common weed. There were, however, monsters lurking in the dense jungle surrounding the town, including jaguars. To guard against such predators, as well as against mosquitoes and sand fleas, the villagers lived in thatch-roofed bamboo huts raised up on stakes as much as 20 feet above the ground. Atacama's was known for its game birds. Soon after the Nantucket whale ship Lucy Adams also dropped harbor, Pollard set out with her captain, 37-year-old Shubael Hussey, on what Nickerson described as a turkey-hunting expedition. In preparation for this all-day affair, the cooks of the two vessels baked pies and other delicacies for the hunting party to take with them into the wilderness. The hunters lacked a way to flush out the game. I, being the youngest boy on board, Nickerson remembered, was chosen to make up the company in place of a hunter's dog. And so they were off, over the meadows and through the woods toward the hunting grounds. About 3 hours out, they heard the most dismal howling that can be imagined. Doing their best to ignore the cries, the two captains pushed on until it became clear that they were rapidly approaching the source of the disturbing sound. What could it be, Nickerson wondered, a bloodthirsty jaguar? But no one said a word. Finally, the two noble whale hunters stopped and looked at each other a few moments as though they wished to say something which each was ashamed to open first. As if on cue, they turned around and began walking back to town, casually remarking that it was too hot an afternoon to hunt and that they would return on a cooler day. But there was no fooling their surrogate hunting dog. They were afraid some beast of prey would devour them, Nickerson wrote, and that I could not find my way back, being too young to tell their anxious wives what became of them. On a subsequent voyage to the region, Nickerson would discover the source of the sounds that had struck such terror in the hearts of these two whaling captains. A harmless bird, smaller than a chickadee. Something happened in Atacama's that profoundly influenced the morale of the crew. Henry DeWitt, one of the Essex's African-American sailors, deserted. DeWitt's act came as no great surprise. Sailors fled from whale ships all the time. Once a green hand realized how little money he was likely to make at the end of a voyage, he had no incentive to stay on if he had better options. However, the timing of the desertion could not have been worse for Captain Pollard. Since each whaleboat required a 6-man crew, this now left only 2 shipkeepers whenever whales were being hunted. 2 men could not safely manage a square-rigged ship the size of the Essex. If a storm should kick up, they would find it almost impossible to shorten sail. Yet Pollard, in a hurry to reach the offshore ground by November, had no alternative but to set out to sea shorthanded. Down a crew member and a whaleboat, the Essex was about to head out farther off the coast of South America than she had ever sailed before. On October 2nd, the Essex set a course for the Galapagos Islands, approximately 600 miles off the coast of Ecuador. Referred to as the Galapagoses by some seamen, these islands were also known as the Encantadas, Spanish for enchanted or bewitched. The strong and unpredictable currents that boiled in and around these volcanic outcroppings sometimes created the illusion that the islands were actually moving. Even before the discovery of the offshore ground, the Galapagos had been a popular provisioning stop for whalers. Safely removed from the mainland, they provided a welcome refuge from the political turmoil in South America. They were also located in a region frequented by sperm whales. As early as 1793, just 2 years after the beaver first rounded the Horn, Captain James Colnett, on a British exploratory voyage to investigate the potential for whaling in the Pacific, visited the Galapagos. What he found was part sperm whale boudoir, part nursery. He and his crew witnessed something almost never seen by man, sperm whales copulating, the bull swimming upside down and beneath the female. They also spied vast numbers of baby whales, not larger than a small porpoise. Colnett wrote, "I am disposed to believe that we were now at the general rendezvous of the spermaceti whales from the coasts of Mexico, Peru, and the Gulf of Panama, who come here to calve." He noted that of all the whales they killed, they found only one male. Colnett's observations are in keeping with the results of the latest research on the sperm whales of the Galapagos. One of the world's premier sperm whale experts, Hal Whitehead, began observing whales in this area in 1985. Using a cruising sailboat equipped with sophisticated technological gadgetry, Whitehead has monitored whales in the same waters plied by the Essex 180 years ago. He has found that the typical pod of whales, which ranges between 3 and 20 or so individuals, is comprised almost exclusively of interrelated adult females and immature whales. Adult males made up only 2% of the whales he observed. The females work cooperatively in taking care of their young. The calves are passed from whale to whale so that an adult is always standing guard when the mother is feeding on squid thousands of feet below the ocean's surface. As an older whale raises its flukes at the start of a long dive, the calf will swim to another nearby adult. Young males leave the family unit at around 6 years of age and make their way to the cooler waters of the high latitudes. Here they live singly or with other males, not returning to the warm waters of their birth until their late 20s. Even then, a male's return is fairly fitful and inconclusive. He spends only 8 or so hours with any one group, sometimes mating but never establishing any strong attachments, before making his way back to the high latitudes. He may live for 60 or 70 years. The sperm whale's network of female-based family units resembled, to a remarkable extent, the community the whalemen had left back home on Nantucket. In both societies, the males were itinerants. In their dedication to killing sperm whales, the Nantucketers had developed a system of social relationships that mimicked those of their prey. During their 6-day passage to the Galapagos, the men of the Essex killed 2 whales, bringing their total amount of oil to 700 barrels, about halfway to filling the ship. They had been out just over a year, and if they should experience some good luck in the offshore ground, there was a chance they might be returning to Nantucket within the next year and a half. But by the time they reached Hood Island, the easternmost of the Galapagos group, their prime concern had shifted from killing whales to keeping their vessel afloat. The Essex had developed a leak. Surrounded by the bone-white beaches of Stephens Bay, which almost seemed to glow at night, the officers supervised the Essex's repair. In the well-protected anchorage, the Essex was hove down, heeled over on her side to expose the problem area. 6 years later, Captain Seth Coffin would use the same procedure in repairing a leak in the Aurora, the ship originally commanded by Daniel Russell on her maiden voyage. Coffin was disturbed to find that the bottom of this far-from-old vessel was eaten to a honeycomb, and attempted to staunch the leak with a mixture of chalk and slush, a greasy material used to lubricate the ship's spars. The much older Essex may have had similar problems below the waterline. Nickerson's attention was soon directed to Hood Island. "The rocks appear very much burned," he remembered, "and where there is soil, it wears mostly the appearance of very dry snuff." Since Hood's surface was covered with loose gravel and boulders, the simple act of walking was difficult, and the volcanic rocks rang metallically underfoot. Herman Melville was profoundly affected by the Galapagos in the 1840s, ultimately writing a series of sketches entitled The Encantadas. For Melville, there was something terrifyingly non-human about these islands. He described them as a place where change never comes, and spoke of their emphatic uninhabitableness. "Cut by the equator, they know not autumn, and they know not spring. While already reduced to the lees of fire, ruin itself can work little more upon them. The showers refresh the deserts, but in these isles rain never falls. Like split Syrian gourds left withering in the sun, they are cracked by an everlasting drought beneath a torrid sky. Have mercy upon me, the wailing spirit of the Encantada seems to cry, and send Lazarus that he may dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am tormented in this flame." To sea travelers, one great attraction of the Galapagos was their tortoises. The naturalist Charles Darwin visited these islands in 1835 aboard the Beagle and noted that the tortoises on each island, like his famous finches, varied markedly from one another, the tortoises in the coloring and shape of their shells. The creatures were interesting in another way to U.S. Navy Captain David Porter. His frigate Essex visited the islands in 1813 and carried off a vast number of tortoises, an estimated 4 tons, to feed his crew on their voyage to the Marquesas. By the time the whale ship Essex ventured to these islands 7 years later, sailors had devised a well-established procedure for what they called turpenning. Equipped with canvas harnesses, the seamen fanned out over the island, often following the deeply rutted tortoise tracks that crisscrossed the rocky surface, hoping these would lead them to their prey. The tortoises averaged about 80 pounds, but it wasn't unusual to find one that weighed 400 pounds or more. If a sailor came across a tortoise that was too big for one person to carry, he'd call for help by crying out, "Town ho!" a corruption of the Wampanoag whaling word, "townor." In most cases, however, it was just one man per tortoise. After flipping the tortoise on its back and pinning it down with a large rock, which kept the creature from retracting its feet, the whaleman secured the ends of his canvas harness to the tortoise's legs, then swung the animal onto his back. Walking for several miles over the uneven surface of Hood Island in 105-degree temperatures, with an 80-pound tortoise strapped to one's back, was not easy, particularly since each man was expected to bring back 3 tortoises a day to the ship. As far as Nickerson was concerned, turpenning was the most difficult and exhausting form of work he'd ever known, especially given the tortoise's constant uneasiness while strapped to a seaman's sweat-soaked back. During their stay at Hood Island, Benjamin Lawrence, Owen Chase's boat steerer, ran into trouble. He found a tortoise and set out in what he thought was the direction of the ship, belatedly realizing he'd gone in precisely the opposite direction. Eventually, he abandoned his tortoise and made his way down to the burning sands of the beach and began to backtrack toward the ship. By the middle of the afternoon, the Essex was still not in sight, and Lawrence was feeling the torments of severe thirst. He came across another tortoise and proceeded to cut off the reptile's snake-like head. The blood spurting from the neck was a startlingly cool 62 degrees in the 110-degree sun. After drinking his fill, Lawrence left the dead tortoise on the beach and resumed his search for the ship. He found it at dusk, but dreading what Nickerson termed the laugh which would be turned upon him if he returned to the boat empty-handed, he headed back into the island's interior in search of a tortoise. It was thoroughly dark by the time Lawrence, tortoise-laden, staggered down to the beach and was greeted by the men who had been sent out to search for him. In the next 4 days, the crew collected 180 tortoises on Hood. Then the Essex headed for nearby Charles Island. The short cruise gave Nickerson the opportunity to observe the creatures, which were, for the most part, stacked like boulders in the hold, although some of them were left to wander the ship's deck. One of the reasons Galapagos tortoises were so valued by the whalemen was that they could live for more than a year without any food or water. Not only was the tortoise's meat still plump and tasty after that long period, but it also yielded as much as 8 to 10 pounds of fat, which Nickerson described as clear and pure as the best of yellow butter and of a rich flavor. Some sailors insisted that the tortoises felt no pangs of hunger during their time on a whale ship, but Nickerson was not so sure. As the voyage progressed, he noticed that they were constantly licking everything they encountered on the ship's deck. The tortoises' gradual starvation ended only when they were slaughtered for food. On Charles Island, the whalemen had created a crude post office, a simple box or cask sheltered by a giant tortoise shell, in which mail could be left for transportation back to Nantucket. While on Charles during the War of 1812, Captain David Porter had used, to his tactical advantage, information gleaned from letters left by British whaling captains. For the men of the Essex, the Charles Island mail drop offered an opportunity to reply to the letters they had received via the Aurora. They also collected another 100 tortoises. Nickerson claimed that these tortoises, which proved disappointingly scarce, were the sweetest tasting of the Galapagos. It was on Charles Island that they procured a 600-pound monster of a tortoise. It took 6 men to carry it to the beach on crossed poles. No one knew how old a tortoise of this size might be, but on nearby Albemarle Island there was Port Royal Tom, a giant tortoise whose shell had been carved with countless names and dates, the oldest going back to 1791. Tom was reported still to be alive as late as 1881. Nickerson, who exhibited a Darwin-esque interest in the natural world, made careful note of the many other creatures inhabiting Charles Island, including green tortoises, pelicans, and 2 kinds of iguanas. During his last day on the island, however, Nickerson was shaken by an event more in keeping with Melville's vision of the Galapagos than with Darwin's. On the morning of October 22nd, Thomas Chappell, a boat steerer from Plymouth, England, decided to play a prank. Not telling anyone else on the Essex what he was up to, the mischievous Chappell, who was, according to Nickerson, fond of fun at whatever expense, brought a tinderbox ashore with him. As the others searched the island for tortoises, Chappell secretly set a fire in the underbrush. It was the height of the dry season, and the fire soon burned out of control, surrounding the tortoise hunters and cutting off their route back to the ship. With no other alternative, they were forced to run through a gauntlet of flame. Although they singed their clothes and hair, no serious injuries resulted, at least not to the men of the Essex. By the time they returned to the ship, almost the entire island was ablaze. The men were indignant that one of their own had committed such a stupid and careless act. But it was Pollard who was the most upset. The captain's wrath knew no bounds, Nickerson remembered, swearing vengeance upon the head of the incendiary should he be discovered. Fearing a certain whipping, Chappell did not reveal his role in the conflagration until much later. Nickerson believed that the fire killed thousands upon thousands of tortoises, birds, lizards, and snakes. The Essex had left a lasting impression on the island. When Nickerson returned to Charles years later, it was still a blackened wasteland. Wherever the fire raged, neither trees, shrubbery, nor grass have since appeared, he reported. Charles would be one of the first islands in the Galapagos to lose its tortoise population. Although the crew of the Essex had already done its part in diminishing the world's sperm whale population, it was here on this tiny volcanic island that they contributed to the eradication of a species. When they weighed anchor the next morning, Charles remained an inferno. That night, after a day of sailing west along the equator, they could still see it burning against the horizon. Backlit by the red glow of a dying island, the 20 men of the Essex ventured into the farthest reaches of the Pacific, looking for another whale to kill. Chapter 5. The Attack. Even today, in an age of instantaneous communication and high-speed transportation, the scale of the Pacific is difficult to grasp. Sailing due west from Panama, it is 11,000 miles to the Malay Peninsula, almost four times the distance Columbus sailed to the New World, and it is 9,600 miles from the Bering Strait to Antarctica. The Pacific is also deep. Hidden beneath its blue surface are some of the planet's most spectacular mountain ranges, with canyons that plunge more than 6 miles into the watery blackness. Geologically, the volcano-rimmed Pacific is the most active part of the world. Islands rise up, islands disappear. Herman Melville called this 64-million-square-mile ocean the tide-beating heart of the Earth. By November 16, 1820, the Essex had sailed more than 1,000 miles west of the Galapagos, following the equator as if it were an invisible lifeline leading the ship ever farther into the largest ocean in the world. Nantucket whalemen were familiar with at least part of the Pacific. Over the last 3 decades, the coast of South America had become their own backyard. They also knew the western edge of the Pacific quite well. By the early part of the century, English whalers, most of them captained by Nantucketers, were regularly rounding the Cape of Good Hope and taking whales in the vicinity of Australia and New Zealand. In 1815, Hezekiah Coffin, the father of Pollard's young cousin Owen, had died during a provisioning stop in the fever-plagued islands off Timor, between Java and New Guinea. Lying between the island of Timor and the west coast of South America is the Central Pacific, what Owen Chase called an almost untraversed ocean. The longitudes and latitudes of islands with names such as Oahuahoa, Marikini, Awaihi, and Maui might be listed in Captain Pollard's navigational guide, but beyond that they were, save for blood-chilling rumors of native butchery and cannibalism, a virtual blank. All this was about to change. Unknown to Pollard only a few weeks earlier on September 29th, the Nantucket whale ships Equator and Balaena stopped at the Hawaiian island of Oahu for the first time. In 1823, Richard Macy would be the first Nantucketer to provision his ship at the Society Islands, now known as French Polynesia. But as far as Pollard and his men knew in November of 1820, they were at the edge of an unknown world filled with unimaginable dangers. And if they were to avoid the fate of the ship they'd encountered at Atacama's, whose men had almost died of scurvy before they could reach the South American coast for provisions, there was no time for far-flung exploration. It had taken them more than a month to venture out this far, and it would take at least that to return. They had at most only a few months of whaling left before they must think about returning to South America, and eventually to Nantucket. So far, the whales they had sighted in this remote, expansive ocean had proved frustratingly elusive. Nothing occurred worthy of note during this passage, Nickerson remembered, with the exception of occasionally chasing a wild shoal of whales to no purpose. Tensions mounted among the Essex's officers. The situation prompted Owen Chase to make an adjustment aboard his whaleboat. When he and his boat crew did finally approach a whale on November 16th, it was he, Chase reported, not his boat steerer, Benjamin Lawrence, who held the harpoon. This was a radical and, for Lawrence, humiliating turn of events. A mate took over the harpoon only after he had lost all confidence in his boat steerer's ability to fasten to a whale. William Comstock told of 2 instances when mates became so disgusted with their boat steerer's unsuccessful attempts to harpoon whales that they ordered them aft and took the iron themselves. One mate, Comstock wrote, screamed, "Who are you? What are you? Miserable trash, scum of Nantucket, a whimpering boy from the chimney corner? By Neptune, I think you are afraid of a whale." When the boat steerer finally burst into tears, the mate ripped the harpoon from his hands and ordered him to take the steering oar. With Chase at the bow and Lawrence relegated to the steering oar, the first mate's boat approached a patch of water where, Chase predicted, a whale would surface. Chase was, in his own words, standing in the forepart, with the harpoon in my hand, well braced, expecting every instant to catch sight of one of the shoal which we were in, that I might strike. Unfortunately, a whale surfaced directly under their boat, hurling Chase and his crew into the air. Just as had occurred after their first attempt at killing a whale off the Falkland Islands, Chase and his men found themselves clinging to a wrecked whaleboat. Given the shortage of spare boats aboard the Essex, Caution on the part of the officers might have been expected, but caution, at least when it came to pursuing whales, was not part of the first mate's makeup. Taking to heart the old adage, a dead whale or a stove boat, Chase reveled in the risk and danger of whaling. The profession is one of great ambition, he would boast in his narrative, and full of honorable excitement. A tame man is never known amongst them. 4 days later, on November 20th, more than 1,500 nautical miles west of the Galapagos and just 40 miles south of the equator, the lookout saw spouts. It was about 8 in the morning of a bright, clear day. Only a slight breeze was blowing. It was a perfect day for killing whales. Once they had sailed to within a half mile of the shoal, the two shipkeepers headed the Essex into the wind with the main topsail aback, and the three boats were lowered. The whales, unaware that they were being pursued, sounded. Chase directed his men to row to a specific spot where they waited in anxious expectation, scanning the water for the dark shape of a surfacing sperm whale. Once again, Chase tells us, he was the one with the harpoon, and sure enough, a small whale emerged just ahead of them and spouted. The first mate readied to hurl the harpoon, and for the second time in as many days of whaling, ran into trouble. Chase had ordered Lawrence, the ex-harpooner, to steer the boat in close to the whale. Lawrence did so, so close that as soon as the harpoon sliced into it, the panicked animal whacked the already battered craft with its tail, opening up a hole in the boat's side. As water poured in, Chase cut the harpoon line with a hatchet and ordered the men to stuff their coats and shirts into the jagged opening. While one man bailed, they rowed back to the ship. Then they pulled the boat up onto the Essex's deck. By this time, both Pollard's and Joy's crews had fastened to whales. Angered that he had once again been knocked out of the hunt, Chase began working on his damaged boat with a fury, hoping to get the craft operable while whales were still to be taken. Although he could have outfitted and lowered the extra boat, the one they had bargained for in the Cape Verde Islands now lashed to the rack over the quarterdeck, Chase felt it would be faster to repair the damaged boat temporarily by stretching some canvas across the hole. As he nailed the edges of the canvas to the boat, his after-oarsman, Thomas Nickerson, all of 15 years old, took over the helm of the Essex and steered the ship toward Pollard and Joy, whose whales had dragged them several miles to leeward. It was then that Nickerson saw something off the port bow. It was a whale, a huge sperm whale, the largest they'd seen so far, a male about 85 feet long, they estimated, and approximately 80 tons. It was less than 100 yards away, so close that they could see that its giant, blunt head was etched with scars, and that it was pointed toward the ship. But this whale wasn't just large. It was acting strangely. Instead of fleeing in panic, it was floating quietly on the surface of the water, puffing occasionally through its blowhole, as if it were watching them. After spouting 2 or 3 times, the whale dove, then surfaced less than 35 yards from the ship. Even with the whale just a stone's throw from the Essex, Chase did not see it as a threat. His appearance and attitude gave us at first no alarm, he wrote. But suddenly, the whale began to move. Its 20-foot-wide tail pumped up and down. Slowly at first, with a slight side-to-side waggle, it picked up speed until the water crested around its massive barrel-shaped head. It was aimed at the Essex's port side. In an instant, the whale was only a few yards away, coming down for us, Chase remembered, with great celerity. In desperate hopes of avoiding a direct hit, Chase shouted to Nickerson, "Put the helm hard up!" Several other crew members cried out warnings. Scarcely had the sound of the voices reached my ears, Nickerson remembered, when it was followed by a tremendous crash. The whale rammed the ship just forward of the forechains. The Essex shook as if she had struck a rock. Every man was knocked off his feet. Galapagos tortoises went skittering across the deck. We looked at each other with perfect amazement, Chase recalled, deprived almost of the power of speech. As they pulled themselves up off the deck, Chase and his men had good reason to be amazed. Never before, in the entire history of the Nantucket whale fishery, had a whale been known to attack a ship. In 1807, the whale ship Union had accidentally plowed into a sperm whale at night and sunk, but something very different was happening here. After the impact, the whale passed underneath the ship, bumping the bottom so hard that it knocked off the false keel, a formidable 6x12-inch timber. The whale surfaced at the Essex's starboard quarter. The creature appeared, Chase remembered, stunned with the violence of the blow, and floated beside the ship, its tail only a few feet from the stern. Instinctively, Chase grabbed a lance. All it would take was one perfectly aimed throw, and the first mate might slay the whale that had dared to attack a ship. This giant creature would yield more oil than two, maybe even three normal-sized whales. If Pollard and Joy also proved successful that day, they would be boiling down at least 150 barrels of oil in the next week, more than 10% of the Essex's total capacity. They might be heading back to Nantucket in a matter of weeks instead of months. Chase motioned to stab the bull, still lying hull to hull with the Essex. Then he hesitated. The whale's flukes, he noticed, were perilously close to the ship's rudder. If provoked, the whale might smash the delicate steering device with its tail. They were too far from land, Chase decided, to risk damaging the rudder. For the first mate, it was a highly uncharacteristic display of caution. But could Chase have foreseen all that so soon followed, Nickerson wrote. He would probably have chosen the lesser evil and have saved the ship by killing the whale, even at the expense of losing the rudder. A sperm whale is uniquely equipped to survive a head-on collision with a ship. Stretching for a third of its length between the front of the whale's battering ram-shaped head and its vital organs is an oil-filled cavity perfectly adapted to cushioning the impact of a collision. In less than a minute, this 80-ton bull was once again showing signs of life. Shaking off its woozy lethargy, the whale veered off to leeward, swimming approximately 600 yards away. There it began snapping its jaws and thrashing the water with its tail, as if distracted, Chase wrote, with rage and fury. The whale then swam to windward, crossing the Essex's bow at a high rate of speed. Several hundred yards ahead of the ship, the whale stopped and turned in the Essex's direction. Fearful that the ship might be taking on water, Chase had, by this point, ordered the men to rig the pumps. "While my attention was thus engaged," the first mate remembered, "I was aroused with the cry of a man at the hatchway. 'Here he is! He is making for us again!'" Chase turned and saw a vision of fury and vengeance that would haunt him in the long days ahead. With its huge, scarred head halfway out of the water and its tail beating the ocean into a white water wake more than 40 feet across, the whale approached the ship at twice its original speed, at least 6 knots. Chase, hoping to cross the line of his approach before he could get up to us and thus avoid what I knew, if he should strike us again, would prove our inevitable destruction, cried out to Nickerson, "Hard up!" But it was too late for a change of course. With a tremendous cracking and splintering of oak, the whale struck the ship just beneath the anchor secured at the cathead on the port bow. This time the men were prepared for the hit. Still, the force of the collision caused the whalemen's heads to jounce on their muscled necks as the ship lurched to a halt on the slab-like forehead of the whale. The creature's tail continued to work up and down, pushing the 238-ton ship backward until, as had happened after the knockdown in the Gulf Stream, water surged up over the transom. One of the men who had been below decks ran up onto the deck, shouting, "The ship is filling with water!" A quick glance down the hatchway revealed that the water was already above the lower deck, where the oil and provisions were stored. No longer going backward, the Essex was now going down. The whale, having humbled its strange adversary, disengaged itself from the shattered timbers of the copper-sheathed hull and swam off to leeward, never to be seen again. The ship was sinking bow first. The forecastle, where the black sailors slept, was the first of the living quarters to flood, the men's sea chests and mattresses floating on the rising tide. Next, the water surged aft into the blubber room, then into steerage, where Nickerson and the other Nantucketers slept. Soon even the mates' and captain's cabins were awash. As the below decks creaked and gurgled, the black steward, William Bond, on his own initiative, returned several times to the rapidly filling aft cabins to retrieve Pollard's and Chase's trunks, and with great foresight, the navigational equipment. Meanwhile, Chase and the rest of the crew cut the lashing off the spare whaleboat and carried it to the waist of the ship. The Essex began to list dangerously to port. Bond made one last plunge below. Chase and the others carried the whaleboat to the edge of the deck, now only a few inches above the ocean's surface. When the trunks and other equipment had been loaded aboard, everyone, including Bond, scrambled into the boat, the tottering masts and yards looming above them. They were no more than two boat lengths away when the Essex, with an appalling slosh and groan, capsized behind them. Just at that moment, 2 miles to leeward, Obed Hendricks, Pollard's boat steerer, casually glanced over his shoulder. He couldn't believe what he saw. From that distance, it looked as if the Essex had been hit by a sudden squall, the sails flying in all directions as the ship fell onto her beam ends. "Look! Look!" he cried. "What ails the ship? She is upsetting!" But when the men turned to look, there was nothing to see. A general cry of horror and despair burst from the lips of every man, Chase wrote, as their looks were directed for the ship in vain over every part of the ocean. The Essex had vanished below the horizon. The two boat crews immediately released their whales and began rowing back toward the place the Essex should have been, all the time speculating frantically about what had happened to the ship. It never occurred to any of them that, in Nickerson's words, a whale had done the work. Soon enough, they could see the ship's hull floating upon her side and presenting the appearance of a rock. As Pollard and Joy approached, the 8 men crowded into Chase's boat continued to stare silently at the ship. Every countenance was marked with the paleness of despair, Chase recalled. Not a word was spoken for several minutes by any of us. All appeared to be bound in a spell of stupid consternation. From the point at which the whale first attacked to the escape from the capsizing ship, no more than 10 minutes had elapsed. In only a portion of that time, spurred by panic, 8 of the crew had launched an unrigged whaleboat from the rack above the quarterdeck, a process that would have normally taken at least 10 minutes and required the effort of the entire ship's crew. Now here they were, with only the clothes on their backs, huddled in the whaleboat. It was not yet 10 in the morning. It was then that Chase fully appreciated the service that William Bond had rendered them. He had salvaged 2 compasses, 2 copies of Nathaniel Bowditch's New American Practical Navigator, and 2 quadrants. Chase later called this equipment the probable instruments of our salvation. Without them, he added, all would have been dark and hopeless. For his part, Thomas Nickerson was swept by a sense of grief, not for himself, but for the ship. The giant black craft that he had come to know so intimately had been dealt a death blow. "Here lay our beautiful ship, a floating and dismal wreck," Nickerson lamented, "which but a few minutes before appeared in all her glory, the pride and boast of her captain and officers, and almost idolized by her crew." Soon the other 2 whaleboats came within hailing distance, but no one said a word. Pollard's boat was the first to reach them. The men stopped rowing about 30 feet away. Pollard stood at the steering oar, staring at the capsized hulk that had once been his formidable command, unable to speak. He dropped down onto the seat of his whaleboat, so overcome with astonishment, dread, and confusion that Chase could scarcely recognize his countenance. Finally, Pollard asked, "My God, Mr. Chase, what is the matter?" Chase's reply, "We have been stove by a whale." Even by the colossal standards of a sperm whale, an 85-foot bull is huge. Today, male sperm whales, which are on average 3 to 4 times bulkier than females, never grow past 65 feet. Sperm whale expert Hal Whitehead has his doubts that the Essex whale could have been as large as Chase and Nickerson claimed it was. However, the logs of Nantucket whalemen are filled with references to bulls that, given the amount of oil they yielded, must have been on the order of the Essex whale. It is an established fact that whalemen in both the 19th and 20th centuries killed male sperm whales in disproportionate numbers. Not only were they longer than the females, but the male's oil-rich spermaceti organs accounted for a larger portion of that length. In 1820, before a century and a half of selective killing had rid the world of large bulls, it may have indeed been possible to encounter an 85-foot sperm whale. Perhaps the most convincing evidence resides in the hallowed halls of the Nantucket Whaling Museum. There, leaning against the wall, is an 18-foot jaw taken from a bull that was estimated to have been at least 80 feet long. The sperm whale has the largest brain of any animal that has ever lived on Earth, dwarfing even that of the mighty blue whale. The large size of the sperm whale's brain may be related to its highly sophisticated ability to generate and process sound. Just beneath its blowhole, a sperm whale has what the whalemen referred to as a monkey's muzzle, a cartilaginous clapper system that scientists believe to be the source of the clicking sounds it uses to see the world through echolocation. Whales also use clicking signals to communicate over distances of up to 5 miles. Females tend to employ a Morse code-like series of clicks known as a coda, and male sperm whales make slower, louder clicks called clangs. It has been speculated that males use clangs to announce themselves to eligible females and to warn off competing males. Whalemen often herd sperm whales through the hulls of their ships. The sound, steady clicks at roughly half-second intervals, bore such a startling similarity to the tapping of a hammer that the whalemen dubbed the sperm whale the carpenter fish. On the morning of November 20, 1820, sperm whales were not the only creatures filling the ocean with clicking sounds. There was also Owen Chase, busily nailing a piece of canvas to the bottom of an upturned whaleboat. With every blow of his hammer against the side of the damaged boat, Chase was unwittingly transmitting sounds down through the wooden skin of the whale ship out into the ocean. Whether or not the bull perceived these sounds as coming from another whale, Chase's hammering appears to have attracted the creature's attention. Chase maintained that when the whale first struck the ship, it was going about 3 knots, the velocity of a whale at normal cruising speed. Whitehead, whose research vessel was once bumped into by a pregnant whale, speculates that the bull might have even initially run into the Essex by mistake. Whatever prompted the encounter, the whale was clearly not prepared for something as solid and heavy as a whale ship, which at 238 tons weighed approximately 3 times more than it did. The Essex might have been an old, work-worn whale ship, but she had been built to take her share of abuse. She was constructed almost entirely of white oak, one of the toughest and strongest of woods. Her ribs had been hewn from immense timbers, at least a foot square. Over that, laid fore and aft, were oak planks 4 inches thick. On top of the planks was a sheathing of yellow pine, more than half an inch thick. Extending down from the waterline, the point of impact, according to Nickerson, was a layer of copper. The bull had slammed into a solid wooden wall. What had begun as an experimental, perhaps unintentional jab with its head, soon escalated into an all-out attack. Like male elephants, bull sperm whales tend to be loners, moving from group to group of females and juveniles and challenging whatever males they meet along the way. The violence of these encounters is legendary. One whaleman described what happened when a bull sperm whale tried to move in on another bull's group. When the approaching bull attempted to join the herd, he was attacked by one of the established bulls, which rolled over on its back and attacked with its jaw. Large pieces of blubber and flesh were taken out. Both bulls then withdrew and again charged at full tilt. They locked jaws and wrestled, each seemingly to try to break the other's jaw. Great pieces of flesh again were torn from the animals' heads. Next, they either withdrew or broke their holds, and then charged each other again. The fight was even more strenuous this time, and little could be seen because of the boiling spray. The charge and withdrawal were repeated 2 or 3 times before the water quieted, and then for a few seconds, the two could be seen lying head to head. The smaller bull then swam slowly away and did not attempt to rejoin the cows. A whaleboat was dispatched, and the larger bull was captured. The jaw had been broken and was hanging by the flesh. Many teeth were broken, and there were extensive head wounds. Instead of fighting with its jaws and tail, the way whales commonly dispatched whaleboats, the Essex whale rammed the ship with its head, something that Chase insisted has never been heard of amongst the oldest and most experienced whalers. But what most impressed the first mate was the remarkably astute way in which the bull employed its God-given battering ram. Both times the whale had approached the vessel from a direction calculated to do us the most injury by being made ahead and thereby combining the speed of the two objects for the shock. Yet even though it had come at the Essex from ahead, the whale had avoided striking the ship directly head-on, where the ship's heavily reinforced stem, the vertical timber at the leading edge of the bow, might have delivered a mortal gash. Chase estimated that the whale was traveling at 6 knots when it struck the Essex the second time, and that the ship was traveling at 3 knots. To bring the Essex to a complete standstill, the whale, whose mass was roughly a third of the ship's, would have to be moving at more than 3 times the speed of the ship, at least 9 knots. One naval architect's calculations project that if the Essex had been a new ship, her oak planking would have withstood even this tremendous blow. Since the whale did punch a hole in the bow, the Essex's 21-year-old planking must have been significantly weakened by rot or marine growth. Chase was convinced that the Essex and her crew had been the victims of decided, calculating mischief on the part of the whale. For a Nantucketer, it was a shocking thought. If other sperm whales should start ramming ships, it would be only a matter of time before the island's whaling fleet was reduced to so much flotsam and jetsam. Chase began to wonder what unaccountable destiny or design had been at work. It almost seemed as if something, could it have been God, had possessed the beast for its own strange, unfathomable purpose. Whatever or whoever might be behind it, Chase was convinced that anything but chance had sunk the Essex. After listening to the first mate's account of the sinking, Pollard attempted to take command of the dire situation. Their first priority, he announced, was to get as much food and water out of the wreck as possible. To do that, they needed to cut away the masts, so that the still partially floating hull could right. The men climbed onto the ship and began to hack away at the spars and rigging with hatchets from the whaleboats. As noon approached, Captain Pollard shoved off in his boat to take an observation with his quadrant. They were at latitude 0 degrees 40 minutes south, longitude 119 degrees 0 minutes west, just about as far from land as it was possible to be anywhere on Earth. 45 minutes later, the masts had been reduced to 20-foot stumps, and the Essex was floating partly upright again, at a 45-degree angle. Although most of the provisions were unreachable in the lower hold, there were 2 large casks of bread between decks in the waist of the ship. And since the casks were on the Essex's upper side, the men could hope that they were still dry. Through the holes they chopped into the deck, they were able to extract 600 pounds of hardtack. Elsewhere, they broke through the planks to find casks of fresh water, more, in fact, than they could safely hold in their whaleboats. They also scavenged tools and equipment, including 2 pounds of boat nails, a musket, 2 pistols, and a small canister of powder. Several Galapagos tortoises swam to the whaleboats from the wreck, as did 2 skinny hogs. Then it began to blow. In need of shelter from the mounting wind and waves, yet fearful the Essex might at any moment break up and sink like a stone, Pollard ordered that they tie up to the ship but leave at least 100 yards of line between it and themselves. Like a string of ducklings trailing their mother, they spent the night in the lee of the ship. The ship shuddered with each wave. Chase lay sleepless in his boat, staring at the wreck and reliving the catastrophe over and over again in his mind. Some of the men slept, and others wasted the night in unavailing murmurs, Chase wrote. Once, he admitted, he found himself breaking into tears. Part of him was guilt-racked, knowing that if he had only hurled the lance, it might have all turned out differently. When it came time to write his own account of the attack, Chase would neglect to mention that he had the chance to lance the whale, an omission Nickerson made sure to correct in his narrative. But the more Chase thought about it, the more he realized that no one could have expected a whale to attack a ship, and not just once, but twice. Instead of acting as a whale was supposed to, as a creature never before suspected of premeditated violence and proverbial for its inoffensiveness, this big bull had been possessed by what Chase finally took to be a very human concern for the other whales. He came directly from the shoal which we had just before entered, the first mate wrote, and in which we had struck 3 of his companions, as if fired with revenge for their sufferings. As they bobbed in the lee of the wreck, The men of the Essex were of no mind to debate the whale's motives. Their overwhelming question was how 20 men in 3 boats could get out of a plight like this alive. Chapter 6. The Plan. All night the wind blew out of the southeast. Waves beat against the stricken hull, dislodging spars and casks and splintering timbers. Jagged debris might at any time pierce the frail sides of the 3 whaleboats tied up to leeward of the ship, so each officer posted a man in the bow of his boat and commanded him to keep a sharp lookout for floating objects bearing down on them and to shove those objects aside before they could do damage. It was terrifying duty, straining to see what threat would next emerge from the darkness. When the sun lit the eastern horizon, the men rose up, blinking from the bilges of the boats, most of them having had little sleep. "We began to think of doing something," Chase recalled. "What?" We did not know. The 3 boat crews returned to the wreck, and for most of the morning the men wandered about the wave-washed deck in a sort of vacant idleness. The officers instructed them to search for any additional provisions that might have floated up from the depths of the hold during the night. Except for a few more Galapagos tortoises, of which they had already had as many as could be safely carried in the whaleboats, they found nothing of use. The obvious next step was to make preparations for leaving the wreck. But this was a prospect that none of the men wanted to contemplate, no matter how cheerless and desolate their current circumstances might be. "Our thoughts hung about the ship, wrecked and sunken as she was," Chase remembered, "and we could scarcely discard from our minds the idea of her continuing protection." Eventually, some of the men began stripping the sails off the ship to make sails for the 3 whaleboats. Luckily, Chase's trunk contained the necessary needles and twine, and the men set to work. Others were directed to build masts for the whaleboats from the ship's spars. Once the crew had been given specific tasks to accomplish, the change in morale was swift. Nickerson noticed more cheerful faces than we dared to expect. As the men worked, equipping each boat with 2 short masts, 2 sprit sails, and a small sail up forward known as a jib, a lookout remained posted on the stump of the Essex's foremast, gazing out across the ocean for a sail. At noon, Chase took an observation and determined that the prevailing southeasterly winds and westerly current had driven the Essex and her crew almost 50 miles to the northwest of where they'd been the day before, away from the distant coast of South America. For the first mate, this troubling information made clear the necessity of not wasting our time and of endeavoring to seek some relief wherever God might direct us. The wind increased throughout the day, making it difficult to work in the whaleboats, especially when the waves broke across them, drenching the men. The officers realized that some further modifications were necessary to increase the vessel's seaworthiness. Using rough cedar boards from the wreck, the men built up the sides of each boat by more than 1/2 foot. This simple alteration, done almost as an afterthought, proved crucial. The boats must otherwise have taken in so much water, Chase wrote, that all the efforts of 20 such weak, starving men as we afterwards came to be would not have sufficed to keep them from swamping. It was also now clear that they had to work out some method of shielding their provisions of bread from the salt spray. Each end of the whaleboat contained a cupboard-like space called a cuddy. After wrapping the bread in several layers of canvas, they placed it in the boat's aft cuddy as far as they could from the waves breaking at the bow. Having it in the aft cuddy also made it easy for the officer at the steering oar to monitor the bread's distribution to the rest of the crew. When darkness began to come on, they reluctantly put aside their hammers, nails, needles, and twine, and once again tied up the whaleboats in the lee of the wreck. It was still blowing hard, and all 20 men dreaded what Chase called the horrors of another tempestuous night. It wasn't just the discomfort of attempting to sleep in a tiny rocking boat, but also the prospect of an entire night with nothing to distract them from their fears. The same men who had worked so cheerfully at modifying the whaleboats were suddenly bludgeoned by despair. The miseries of their situation came upon them with such force, Chase remembered, as to produce spells of extreme debility, approaching almost to fainting. Even though it had been almost 2 days since their last meal, they found it impossible to eat. Their throats parched by anxiety, They indulged instead in frequent drinks of water. Chase lay down in the bottom of his boat and began to pray, but his supplication provided little consolation. Sometimes a light hope would dawn, but then, to feel such an utter dependence on chance alone for aid and rescue, would chase it again from my mind. Rather than contemplating the possible means of their deliverance, Chase found himself once again reliving the circumstances that had brought them to this point, especially the mysterious and mortal attack of the animal. By 7 o'clock the next morning, the ship's deck had broken almost entirely from the hull. Like a whale dying in a slow-motion flurry, the Essex in dissolution made for a grim and disturbing sight, her joints and seams working violently in the waves. She was bleeding from the burst casks within her hull, surrounding the men in a reeking slick of whale oil, a yellowish slime that coated the boat's sides and slopped over the gunwales with the waves. The boats became slippery and dangerous to move around in. The fluid that only a few days before had been their fortune, their obsession, was now their torment. Chase decided that something must be done. He rowed over to Pollard and declared that it was time for them to sail towards the nearest land. The captain stalled, insisting that they scavenge the wreck one last time for provisions they might have overlooked. Only after he had the opportunity for another observation at noon, he said, would he discuss what to do next. Pollard's noon observation revealed that they had drifted 19 miles to the north, taking them across the equator during the night. Now, with their sails ready and Pollard's navigational calculations complete, it was time for what Chase termed a council. So, with his two mates joining him in his whaleboat, Pollard spread out before them their two copies of Bowditch's Navigator and its list of the latitudes and longitudes of Friendly and other islands in the Pacific Ocean, and began the discussion of what they should do. Since their sail-equipped whaleboats could travel only with the wind, their options were quite limited. Backtracking their way to the Galapagos and beyond